south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
You know, there's a question that comes up a lot. How much Big Brother really exists here in Latin America compared to, well, you know, Big Brother states like England, most of Europe, and course, the U.S. We all know Latin countries operate on lag time, but just how big is Big Brother in various Latin American countries? Again, comparatively speaking, and how do you figure that out? What numbers do you use? Well, for one thing, just the phrase Big Brother means nothing to the average Latin American. They don't have a separate Spanish word for it. You have to literally translate it and say Gran Hermano. In fact, the only Latinos I ever come across who really understand the terminology are the kids of the rich who are bilingual and went to first world helicopter schools or attended universities in the States because their parents have that kind of dough. But the fact is, none of them, not even the ones who understand the term completely, would agree that it's actually a threat here in Latin America, unless one lives in a place like Venezuela or Cuba. Well, you know, you can look it up. There is 100% correlation as to how large Big Brother looms in any particular country and how socialistic a country is. And how do you figure out how socialistic a country is? Well, you just look at the percentage of government expenditures versus GDP, gross domestic product, which is nearly 100% correlated to an individual worker's tax burden. That is, how much your government picks your pocket each year through its various taxes. And as it turns out, in the majority of Latin countries, it's like a minor thief just pickpocketing you, as opposed to, let's say, Grand Theft Auto in the U.S. and Europe. And as far as the U.S. government expenditures versus total GDP, the number is appallingly pathetic, around 40%. In other words, the U.S. government's stealing 40% of the productivity of all its citizens. Now, compare that to a country that's beyond a basket case, Venezuela. Last reported data, turns out, over there, government expenditures amounted to around 50% of the country's GDP, though those numbers are unreliable, as you might have figured. And, you know, U.S. government numbers are totally unreliable, too. I mean, really, take the U.S. government's unemployment rate figures. They're saying, what is it, 4%? Even Trump got sucked into that lie. And in reality, governments are so good at lying and juggling statistics, the real unemployment figures are closer to 25%. But you knew that already. All right, so if you figure the U.S. is the world's prime example of a Big Brother state, with government expenditures reaching 40% of GDP, let's talk about how Latin American countries stack up. All right, here's a few examples, and this data is very new, just came out from a big Panamanian newspaper. Let's start with Costa Rica. Now, you may have heard they're following the example of the U.S. in a big way. They've got a huge bloated government sector that's growing all the time, like a malignant cancer. Sound familiar? That's redundant. Malignant cancer. Sorry about that. But still, their government expenditures as a percentage of GDP is only around half of that of the U.S., 21%. Oh, and you longtime listeners may have heard me mention quite a while ago that Uruguay has Latin America's largest percentage of workers in the government slug department, making it basically a society of endless fat-ass dipshits pushing cyclones of paperwork, making the process of trying to get a business started, legally anyway, pure torture. Which is why so many people there with good ideas just end up giving up or diverting their talents to pure internet businesses, which the government can't track or tax. And that, by the way, is another fantastic thing the internet does for us. It makes us free. But get this, even Uruguay, with its vast army of government fat-ass pustulant carbuckles, only sucks up 32% of the government GDP year over year. Now, compare that with the blood-sucking U.S. government that sucks up 40% of GDP. That means 40% of U.S. productivity goes down a rat hole. All right, here's a few more Latin American country examples. Not to bore you, we won't go through the whole list, but El Salvador comes in with a government percentage of GDP at 20.4%. Then there's 20% in Honduras, 18.4% in Nicaragua. Then you have Panama's government expenses versus GDP at 17.6%. Notice that all those examples are coming in at half or less of the U.S. Now guess who's got the lowest government expenditure to GDP of all Latin America? Guatemala, coming in at 12% of GDP. So what's all that mean? Well, you can look at it this way. The closer any government's expenditures to GDP, gross domestic product, approach figures you see in the U.S. and Europe, with Europe being even worse than the U.S., the more socialist a country is and the more Big Brother influence. Of course, you know, not all the people working in government up in the States are slugs. There are some people who take their jobs very seriously, especially people in those countless alphabet agencies who collect data, have guns in force behind them, and love to exert that power, like NSA, FBI, CIA, the IRS, Homeland Security, etc. And that's the big difference between Big Brother up in the States and Big Brother, even in a place like Uruguay. Because, you know, in the States, there's no such thing as mañana time. Up there by you, the computers work, they're all linked, the cameras are maintained, and government enforcers with vehicles actually have unlimited amounts of petrol. Whereas down here in Latin America, you heard me say many times before that in a lot of these Latin countries, the cops are issued 2 gallons of gas a day. Oh, and here's a good example how government works down here. You know, every Latin country has an air force, but rarely do the planes or jets fly. And not for the lack of pilots wanting to get up to the wild blue yonder, they all love to fly, it's just they haven't got the jet fuel. Oh, and by the way, I've spoken over the years to a couple of pilots in various Central American air forces, and one of them told me they fly only once a month, but not just because of fuel issues. It's typical that half of the Air Force planes, jets, and helicopters, and let's use Guatemala as an example, at last count, I believe they've got 12 jets in their air force, and 6 of them are grounded, that is, out of commission at any given time, because of the usual maintenance and spare parts problems. All right, now here's something I bet you didn't know. Let's talk about the special Big Brother case of Colombia. And I'm not much of a fan of Colombia, as you probably figured. Oh, it's a nice place to visit, all right, but I'd never want to live there. Because of all Latin countries, except for the totally socialist ones like Venezuela and Cuba, it's really on the fast track to being a Big Brother state. And I'm not talking about a Latin-style Big Brother state that's on mañana time either. I'm talking about a U.S.-style Big Brother, where there's real enforcement and the cameras and computers actually work. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that there are 4 U.S. military bases in Colombia. Does that sound good to you? Are you okay with that? In fact, in 2010, the U.S. signed an agreement with Colombia to put 7 bases there, but the Colombian Supreme Court ruled against it. And you know, some people say, there are no U.S. military bases in Colombia. Well, they're quasi-U.S. military bases. They're staffed mostly by Colombians, but the U.S. funds, trains, and basically is in complete control of them. In fact, every time I've visited Colombia, I've run into U.S. soldiers, jarheads, DEA guys. Oh, they're all right. So I'm asking you again, are you okay with that? And since Colombia has always been considered the nexus of the international drug trade, you can damn well bet they've got surveillance going there they don't have in any other Latin country. In fact, would it surprise you to know that their government expenditures are equal to the U.S., 40% of their GDP? That tells the whole story and why I'd never want to live there. On top of that, the cancer in Colombian government is metastatic. Listen to this. According to the latest OECD report, whatever that stands for, let me quote this exactly. It says, in Colombia, compensation for senior managers in the central government in GDP per capita terms is the highest in all measured countries, not just Latin America. Then it says, although senior officials in Colombian government earn less than U.S. averages, the managers earn more than double the average of other countries when compensation is measured relative to GDP per capita. Which is why it's no surprise when Colombians are polled, they almost always say they'd like to work for government. Now, what does that figure actually mean? That means 40% of all the productivity or manpower in a country like the U.S. or Colombia is wasted. That means there are thousands, if not millions, of government slugs sitting in cubicles looking at their monitors, checking their Facebook and Instagram accounts, surfing the net, just holding on and biding their time for when they retire so they can get a pension that's double or even triple of what the average person with a similar job gets in the private sector. But let's go into this a little deeper. Did you know that in Colombia, the minimum wage is $328 a month? Pretty much in line with most all Latin countries. That's the minimum wage. Now compare that with the minimum wage in the States. It's all over the map now. It depends where you live, right? In some states, it's $8 an hour. And in others, like Washington State, it's 15, I hear. So averaging it out, let's say $10 an hour minimum wage in the States, that's around $1,600 a month. Versus Columbia's $328 a month. About a fifth of the average minimum wage in the States. But the average wage in Colombia is much higher, just like the average wage in the States is much higher than minimum wage. The average wage in Colombia is around $700 a month. All right, you can look it up yourself, but I'm seeing the average monthly wage in the U.S. is around $3,700. That's seven times higher than the average Colombian wage. All right, so far so good. Now let's look at Colombian government workers' salaries. Get this, the average Colombian government secretarial position pays around $20,000 a year. In the private sector, around $6,000 to $7,000 a year. Less than half of what a sitting on your fat ass pushing around paperwork, posting bowel movements on Facebook and Instagram government secretarial position pays. Oh, and by the way, if you're a secretary working for the U.S. government, your average salary is, get this, $53,000 a year. Oh, man, pass me a cyanide capsule, will you? All right, let's talk about Colombian middle managers in government. They make around $107,000 a year. Middle managers in the private sector, $36,000 a year. Wow, can you see why every Colombian wants to work for the government? By the way, a middle management job in the U.S. government pays $137,000. Oh, man, when is that cyanide capsule going to kick in? All right, one more small bunch of stats here. It says, if you're a senior professional working in Colombian government, that would be like a doctor or engineer, architect, software designer, whatever. You're making around $70,000 a year. A veritable fortune if you're living in Latin America. In the private sector, $25,000 a year. So again, if you're working for government, sitting on your dead ass, pushing paper and checking your Facebook page, smoking crack in the boys' room and finding places to hide, you're making around three times as much as a guy or a gal with the same title and profession working a real job that actually counts in the private sector. So there you have some of the reasons why I wouldn't want to live in Colombia. Though I wouldn't want to live in Uruguay either. I don't even like visiting there. Not the least of which is because it's kind of ugly. Pretty much just flat and boring like Ohio. It's got beaches, but they're by no means crystal clear like in the Caribbean. And Montevideo, the capital? Scruffy, ugly, uninteresting, and not a lot to do. Of course, that's my opinion. And I'm sticking with it because I've been there. I've got a good amount of boots on the ground. But do feel free to prove me wrong. Go ahead, book a trip and check it out for yourself. Oh, and speaking of Uruguay, we don't talk about Uruguay much, do we? Well, as mentioned in the past show, it's got probably the highest percentage of people working in government of any Latin country that's not a socialist one like Venezuela or Cuba. Though technically Uruguay is a socialist country, and because socialist countries have heavy, heavy bureaucracy and very few productive workers, that means motivated, creative people who want to start businesses often just say, screw it. What's the use? And sometimes they leave and go to a more business-friendly country, or do it on the net, or just throw in the towel and don't even give it a try, or get a job in government. Well, anyway, Uruguay is completely broke. It's bankrupt like most other governments. The thing is, what was floating them, that is, bringing in the dough, were rich Argentinos coming to Punta del Este, that's their beach town, to buy overpriced property and use the Uruguay banking system, whose bank secrecy laws were really tight. That was a way to hide their dough from Argentine tax authorities who were draining the blood out of them. And they were getting away with it quasi-legally because, unlike the U.S., most Latin countries do not tax outside source income. So for decades, wealthy Argentines would use that little tax loophole to bring in cash and deposit it in their favorite bank in Uruguay. But now that the Uruguay government's broke, they're desperate to find ways to fill their coffers. So here's the latest kind of crazy step the government's taking to kill the cash cow. That would be biting the Argentine hand that feeds them. The title of the article, Uruguay bans all cash payments of $5,000 or more. It says Uruguay sanctioned its financial inclusion law, that's what they're calling it, which bans cash payments worth more than $5,000. Property transactions and car purchases will thus have to now be made through banking mechanisms, wire transfers and such, which can now be monitored and taxed by authorities. Then it says, this measure affects thousands of Argentinos who snapped up properties across River Plate, primarily in the summer favorite destination, Punta del Este. Then it says, according to the Uruguayan daily El País, if a property is bought with funds located in another country, property deeds will now have to include details on how the transactions were made, including account numbers, where the money originated from, and the names of the buyers and the sellers and the bank where the funds came from and the origin of those funds. Sounds just like FATCA and GATCA on steroids, this time applied to property deals. Anyway, it says recipients of income from rental contracts, too, will also have to declare a bank account to which funds will be deposited and where those funds came from. And get this, it says management firms, property developers, lawyers, and notaries, and all of their fees and payments, as well as commissions from real estate agencies, will also have to be made electronically and reported. In addition, it says taxes will have to be paid electronically at the time of the transaction, regardless of the sum that is owed. Meanwhile, one prominent financial advisor says, quote, although the government might claim it's to make financial operations more transparent, the measure was obviously designed by the Uruguayan government to improve the country's international credit rating and bond profile so they could borrow even more on the open market. Anyway, the article goes on to say the Argentines have been flocking to Uruguay for years, and what Argentine authorities have been calling tax evasion has turned out to be a boon for the tiny neighboring country of Uruguay, though that seems to be coming to an end. It says there are many ways Argentines with money have been setting up tax evasion schemes in Uruguay. Take the recent example of professional tennis player Juan Martín del Potro. It's been confirmed he's been under investigation for tax evasion that cost state coffers in Argentina more than 1 million pesos. Investigators claim he diverted revenue from advertising and cash prizes from tournaments to a company called Bongarden that his parents set up for him in their names in Uruguay. Then it goes on to say there are many Uruguayan federal agents working at borders and at the airport, and they're catching people with hordes of hidden cash all the time. And guess what? They take it from you. Sound familiar? And the people found with cash and have that money taken from them, they almost never file a complaint because then you have to go to court. They'll be branded as tax evaders in their home country, Argentina, and will have to face charges there too. In fact, it says just last week, the Uruguayan Federal Public Income Administration, their version of the IRS or Tax Revenue Service, recovered $86,500 hidden in secret compartments by people crossing the Argentine-Uruguay border legally. Then it says authorities report most of the hidden cash comes via ferry from one of the many terminals in Buenos Aires that ends up in Colonia del Sacramento in Uruguay. All right, that said, let's take an email. And the writer here is poking fun at me for my pronunciation of certain Spanish words, and I guess I deserve it. But in my defense, I have to say a lot of those Mayan and indigenous names would tongue-tie anyone. He starts out, Johnny, bottom line, Oaxaca, Mexico. Johnny, you killed that word. You filleted it good. The Mexican X has a long history, Johnny. I forget the details, but the most common pronunciation is like the English H, which of course usually is spelled as a J in Spanish. Thus, Mexico is sometimes spelled Mexico with a J, which is uncommon, that's like an older term. But on the other hand, Mexicano is often spelled Mexicano with a J instead of an X. Whereas with some indigenous languages, the SH sound translated in Spanish became spelled with an X, thus Chela, X-E-L-A, and some other names, especially in the Mayan regions. And then he says, by the way, Johnny, why would anyone who'd studied Spanish have difficulty with a word like T-E-G-U-C-I-G-A-L-P-A? Tegucigalpa. It perfectly follows all the Spanish pronunciation rules. Then he signs it, your loyal fan, Fred. All right, Fred, you got me checkmated on that one, but remember, I did not go to a liberal arts university. I took no English lit classes. And I took French instead of Spanish in high school. What an idiot, huh? Then directly to engineering school. So as far as English language and Spanish language rules of pronunciation, I could be way off. Oh, which brings to mind that feudal exercise from Catholic school, diagramming sentences. Whoa, did that suck. Anyway, You liberal arts graduates out there have to cut us scientific types some slack, you know. Oh, by the way, Fred, if you've been down here a long time and had boots on the ground, there are different versions of the name Fred. There are Frederico, Fred, Fernando, Ferdinando, Freddy, and in the case of that most famous Pica Piedra means Flintstone, as in Fred Flintstone. Here, he's not Fred at all, he's Pedro. And someday, someone's going to tell me why that is. I don't get it. By the way, the Spanish word for caveman is cavernícola. And when you look at the letters, it kind of makes sense. Cavern as like a cave, cavern. And the nicolo part, well, who knows? Oh, and by the way, for all you woo-woo types out there, I know, woo-woo is in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? I get kind of a kick out of some of that woo-woo stuff myself, especially since my brother, who does not lie, told me of a personal encounter he had with a very strange thing that came down from the sky. But that's a story I'll have to tell in person, because on the air, you will accuse me of being a woo-woo master. So anyway, if you happen to run into me one day or another, ask me about it. Remember, I'm a scientific kind of guy. I read lots and lots of science books, took lots and lots of math and physics, meaning I'm not easily sucked into woo-woo. So what's the point? Well, you know, all over the world, there's that phenomenon known as Bigfoot. Had a girlfriend like that once. For guys, you know, there's some secondary connotations attached to that, but for women, don't know. Except that it's probably hard to find high heel. But then again, I don't think she'd check the stores in the transgender part of town. And down here, in Latin America, high heels are called tacones, often shortened to tacos. No, not tacos as in taco, but I'm talking about tacos as in the short version of tacones. And if you spell that word out, tacone, it has the word tack in it, like, you know, a nail or spike, which is very descriptive of a high heel. So anyway, in pretty much every area of the known world, the legend of Bigfoot persists. They call it in the Asian countries, Yeti, the Yeti. Or as I remember as a kid, watching Warner Brothers cartoons, they called it the Abominable Snowman. So anyway, down here in Latin America, there are legends of Bigfoot too. Though as with the rest of those stories, people say they've seen one, but no one's ever got a nice picture or a lock of hair or come across a freshly dead one or the bones of one or one that was decomposing. But no matter which Latin country you're in, if you bring up the words Gran Pie. Gran is big and pie foot. So there's a direct translation there. People's eyes do light up and the woo-woo factor kicks in. All right, shifting gears again, but not too much. You must have heard of this genius clinical psychologist. Name is Jordan Peterson, right? Man, I tell you, that runaway bestseller of his is called 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos by Jordan Peterson. Man, if there ever was a must-read for liberals and conservatives alike, that is a tremendous book, 12 Rules for Life. By the way, if you're broke and you need a copy, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, and I'll send you a free copy and or a link to the audiobook that would be free too. Will I be getting in trouble if I send those to you? Well, you know, I am in Latin America, so come and get me. Anyway, he's got a ton of fantastic YouTubes. And as for me, I can't sit down and watch YouTubes if they're more than 3 or 4 minutes long. It just cuts into your productive time. So what I like to do if there's things to do around the house, or I'm stuck in a hotel room, whatever, because I don't watch TV, I'll put the YouTube channel on and just listen if I'm stuck doing mundane stuff. Now, this guy, Jordan Peterson, ends up on a lot of panel shows debating liberals and tearing them many new orifices within a very short period of time. But he's so diplomatic, he does it in a kind and gentle kind of way, if that's possible while tearing someone a new one. But I'll tell you, he's been up against them all and no one gets the best of this guy. Anyway, he's my new hero. And people ask him the weirdest questions too. And the other day, someone said, "Are you ever going to retire?" Oh, and by the way, he's done more than 25,000 hours of personal consultations with people. But as to that retirement question, he said the majority of working adults, when asked what they thought would be the ideal retirement, would say, "Sitting by the pool on the nice white sand beach, sucking down Mai Tais or tequila sunrise." And he said, "You know, I've given a lot of thought to that. There's something definitely wrong with that concept, especially for people who are active, happy, busy, successful in their regular life. And now they're talking about sucking down Mai Tais at the beach and fading into the sunset in their golden twilight years. How long's that going to last? 2 weeks before you start crawling out of your skin because you have to have something to do?" Of course, he analyzed it in some detail and was much more eloquent at doing it than I am. But he did come up with the very same conclusion I came up with so many years ago. Yet I still get emails from people who say that's just what they want to do. That's why I always say, come down, get boots on the ground, and rent for at least 6 months. Don't buy something right away. In fact, I'd say one of the worst mistakes a newbie gringo or expat could ever make is come down on vacation for 2 weeks, whatever, Panama, Costa Rica, who knows, get hooked up with a Remax realtor or gringo con man, same thing, and buy a beautiful place, house, cabana, condo, whatever, on the beach. That, my friends, is a recipe for disaster. That is, unless you're Mr. or Ms. Moneybags. Then you could just pick up and leave and not feel too bad about it as cabin fever or beachfront boredom creeps in. And it will. And there's another big mistake I often see with gringos and expats who've been down a while. They buy a house in a Latin city or the burbs. Then, once a month or so, they head out to the nearest beach, could be an hour or two or even three away from where they're living. Then they decide, hey, we got the money, why not get ourselves a little beach house? And you know, as it turns out, it's like having a jacuzzi in your house. For the first 6 months, you use the hell out of it. Then after a couple of years, unless you're having some kind of a party, you almost never use it again. In other words, what I'm saying is the glow of having a beach house wears off pretty fast, especially when you see what kind of expenses are involved, maintenance, etc. And as you're living most of your life somewhere else, maybe in a medium or large city, or even out in the burbs or boonies, who knows, just the thought of having that beach house there with no one using it wears on you. And that sets up, for lack of another term, kind of a guilt complex. You got to start using it, so it becomes a chore. You're thinking, I bought this thing, I put a lot of money into it, I have to start going there. And it does become a chore, like a timeshare, if you remember those things. You're paying for it and you're thinking, that's a burden, you got to get your money's worth. Worse yet, you just can't leave a beach house unoccupied for weeks or months at a time. Because if you don't have live-in help as soon as you get there, you're going to have some work to do. So in effect, what turned out to be such a great idea, maybe even a great investment at the time, turns into something that's more a responsibility than an actual pleasure. Hey, and I'm not just blowing smoke here. I did that. In fact, I did it twice. Is that not stupid? Of course, the second time I did resist, but I had a big shove from a no longer significant other. So I'm talking from experience, and I've heard plenty of expats who have the same thing going, wishing someone would have talked them out of it. But unfortunately, when you're exuberant and so excited about something, almost no one can dissuade you. Then again, if you just love the beach, water sports, surfing, swimming, scuba, whatever, and that's the only place you're going to live, that's another story. I'm talking about having that beach house as a second vacation home. It's not what it's cracked up to be.
You've been listening to the Expat Files Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, you can schedule a one-on-one phone call with me. But first, download my free Plan B questionnaire at www.thenewexpat.com. Better yet, if you want to get your Plan B going from right up there in the States, just sign up for my 9-hour Expat Essentials course. Get the perfect Plan B blueprint by going to theexpatfiles.com/academy.